Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. So long.
And I'm a gone way on down the road so long.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Paul Morphis? Did y'all like Paul? Starting where the crooked paths of folk, country, blues, and bluegrass intersect, Paul Morphis is a one-man band and traveler exploring the terrain of Americana music. He is a member of the Arkansas Arts Council Arts on Tour roster. He has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at mrmorphis.blogspot.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark was a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock artist Carla McGoldrick, and our featured piece is this multimedia piece right over here entitled Well Run Down, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Carla at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's stories are all animal tales, where the animals are all major characters, and let's just say things don't exactly end the way they started for them. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Danny Ramsey is on patrol with his canine partner when things take a turn for the worse. And we'll end the night with Roger Poole and a hungry, lock-picking mule. But let's start the night with Lewis Houston, a very large animal, and a bounty in Old Booger the Wild Hog.
I was 12 years old when I began my quest for Old Booger, the terror hog of Morton Valley. Jake Morton, one of the community leaders, had announced a $500 reward would be given to the person who captured or killed Old Booger, who, I figured, might have a hideout somewhere in the large wooded acreage near our farm. There were huge rocks, fallen logs, several caves, and a nasty swamp area where he could avoid discovery. On our little South Texas farm, we had about 40 hogs confined in a 20-acre pasture with a small wallowing pond. We slopped and tended our hogs daily, but they also consumed acorns, pecans, and whatever else they could root up. Once in a while, a young hog would escape to the adjoining 160-acre tract of woods without our being aware of it immediately. In the wild, hogs will reproduce and develop cunning and skills that tame hogs do not need. Their tusks become awesome weapons, and their bodies become heavily muscled, and they become very predatory. The result can be an animal like Old Booger, who wreaked havoc over our area of small farms for many months. He was rarely sighted because his attacks were usually after midnight. The few farmers who had seen him described him as a huge animal, perhaps 800 pounds, black and brown bristled, with long tusks, fast moving, and generally ferocious in appearance. Fences meant nothing to old Booger. He could break into any pen or field. He killed chickens, dogs, and piglets. He tore up gardens, mated with domestic sows, and seemed hell-bent on destruction. He was the talk of our community. Farmers began to sit up all night, hoping to apprehend and put an end to the rampage of the beast. So when Jake Morton announced the reward, I knew what I would do. I had read about tracking methods in some of my pulp paperbacks. I would look for footprints, trails, broken foliage, and spoor signs to find old Booger. Carrying my .22 rifle, I began to search for tracks through the deep gullies leading into the woods. One evening, I spotted a wild sow and a litter of piglets near a swampy area. Seeing or smelling me, they hurried away. I followed them to a large opening under a massive heap of fallen timbers. They disappeared into it. As it would soon be dark, I decided to go home and come back the next day with my dad. As I walked through a heavily wooded part, I heard a loud crashing sound behind me. I could feel the hair on my neck rise. It had to be old Booger. He was charging toward me and he was squealing mad. I reached for the nearest tree and began climbing it until I found a large branch to stand on. In my hasty climb, I dropped my .22. The monster hog circled the tree, snorting, pawing the ground, and staring up at me with unfettered hatred. His salivating mouth and ominous tusk set my pulse to racing. Then darkness eased over the woods. After a while, old Booger seemed to have given up on me. He disappeared. All was quiet except for hoot owls hooting at each other. I climbed down from the tree and recovered my .22. I climbed back up and began firing into the air at intervals. At last, I heard my name being called, and I saw the beams of flashlights. It was my dad and my grandpa. They were carrying deer rifles. I led them to the hog's den. Old Booger was nowhere to be seen. Then we heard him smashing through the brush. My flashlight caught him as he emerged with lowered head, aiming straight for us. The deer rifles did the job. Old Booger fell dead less than 10 yards from us. Grandpa got his mule team and dragged the huge carcass back to our house. Much to my chagrin, my dad refused the reward. So Mr. Morton donated the $500 to our school's new gymnasium fund. Dad smoked the hams and bacon of the wild hog, and it was surprisingly tasteful. Dad gave most of it to some neighbors with 21 kids. I definitely had my fill of old Booger, and while he may have been tough when he was terrorizing everyone, he was mighty tender when all was said and done.
A retired computer systems manager, Lewis Houston now writes a weekly column for the Siloam Springs newspaper. He lives on rural acreage near Siloam, Arkansas. He grew up on a farm in Central Texas. He is 81. Next, when Danny Ramsey's partner takes off after a ball, he discovers something they both wish he hadn't in Bad Day for a Working Dog.
The ball left my right hand and flew about 40 yards, hit the ground just in front of my partner Yasso and bounced. He jumped like a kangaroo and caught it, then started back in my direction. He dropped the ball at my feet, circled me twice, barking, telling me, "Hurry up, throw it, I'm ready." I threw the ball in a different direction. He got it, and here he came. Again, he dropped it, barked some more. I threw it in yet another direction, but this direction took him into an area of low ground not lit up by the parking lot lights. I momentarily lost sight of him. I was confident that he had the ball and would be headed back any second. Huh, that's strange. I didn't throw it that far. Yasso, come here. It was summertime in Batesville, Arkansas. Because the county could only afford one canine unit for patrol, Yasso and I were working the midnight shift on a 90-day rotation. We had just completed a foot patrol of the downtown business district looking for burglars. Our night so far had been slow, so I decided to drive over to the high school to give my partner some exercise off the leash. Yasso was classified as a multi-purpose working dog. He was a solid black 3-year-old Czechoslovakian shepherd with light green eyes. He weighed about 80 pounds, smaller than a world-famous German shepherd, but he performed his duties and protected his handler with a lot of enthusiasm. His responsibilities were narcotics detection, tracking, handler protection, and suspect apprehension, and he was exceptional at his duties. When he latched onto a suspect, the only way he would let go was by my command. Working dogs are rewarded for their performance, and Yasso expected his reward when a task was performed successfully. Working dogs are seldom rewarded with food. Most dogs are rewarded with a toy, such as a thick piece of rope about a foot long with a knot tied at each end used for tug of war with the handler. Yasso's favorite was a cone-shaped hard rubber ball called a kong, which he was only given for performing a task on command or for exercise. The school grounds provide an ideal place to exercise Yasso. There are large areas of well-maintained grass where he could really run, and the area was well-lit from streetlights located in the surrounding parking lots. As I was parking the car, Yasso had realized where we were. He started jumping around in the car kennel and barking. I stepped out of the car, activated the automatic door opener located on my pistol belt. The door opened, and Yasso launched out of the car. He knew this game. He was focusing all his attention on me to determine which direction I was going to throw the ball. Before the ball was out of my hand, he was off like a rocket. Three throws later, he had not come back. Sensing something wasn't right, I began jogging in his direction, stopping on top of the small hill where I had lost sight of him. Oh, there he is. Well, what's wrong with him? His butt is pointed straight up in the air, tails between his legs. He's pushing himself forward with his hind legs, his massive head down like he was plowing the ground with his nose, frantically rubbing his face with his paws. Suddenly, I saw a movement to my left. My mind quickly processed the evidence being presented, and I was instantly consumed with an overwhelming sense of dread. I stood frozen in a moment and watched in horror as that dirty, stinking son of a skunk made his withdrawal from the crime scene with his white tail standing straight up in the air, announcing to the world his apparent victory over my partner. In that same moment, like a runaway train, I was struck with the unmistakable stench that only another skunk could appreciate. As I was telling myself that this situation couldn't get any worse, I noticed that Yasso had detected my presence and was blindly crawling in my direction. Ears laid down, convinced, I'm sure, that I could make all this go away. The only thing I knew to do at this moment was run. Run like hell. I made a frantic retreat in the direction of my car. Yasso, recognizing me, began running right behind me. His odor was so intense it made me gag. We reached the car. I had to circle it twice because there's no place else to go. Yasso desperately tried to make physical contact with me, but I couldn't bring myself to turn around and face him. What a wreck. I dove onto the trunk of the car. Yasso collapsed on the ground, foaming at the mouth in great sheets that looked like industrial lubricant. I suspect he took a hit in the face at point-blank range. His eyes looked like they were crossed. Now I'm going to throw up. I finally realized I had to deal with this situation. My only option was to put Yasso into the car and go home. We couldn't work the rest of this shift in this condition. Reluctantly, I called my supervisor on the radio and requested that he meet me at my current location. Affirmative, ETA 10 minutes. Yasso was sprawled out on the ground. Would the slobbering ever stop? I opened the door to the kennel and told him to get in. He slowly got up and dragged himself into the car and collapsed onto the floorboard just as my supervisor's headlights appeared. As he approached, he rolled down his window. Then the vehicle came to an abrupt halt 20 feet away and slowly began a tactical withdrawal. I could hear him belly laughing across the parking lot as he was slapping the dash with his hilarity. From the distance, he yelled at me, "Go home. Come back when you get that problem solved." As he pulled away, I heard him radio police dispatch, between bouts of laughter to report my unit was off duty for the rest of the shift. At 3:25 a.m., we began the 26-mile race for home. I had all the windows down and the air conditioner was running on high. We were out of the city now and on county roads. Traffic was light. I was running 70 to 90 miles an hour in an effort to prove air circulation inside the car. The odor was relentless. We made it home in record time. I put Yasso into his kennel located 50 yards from the house. I approached the back door and softly knocked on the door to awaken my sleeping wife. After a couple of minutes, I heard a cautious, "Who is it?" from behind the locked door. "It's me, home a little early." The lock turned and the door opened just a bit as my wife peered out. She looked at me, and I saw her eyes widen and her nose twitch. Then the door slowly closed, and I heard the lock turn once again.
Danny J. Ramsey teaches welding at the University of Arkansas Community College at Batesville and owns his own welding fabrication business. He is a retired law enforcement officer. He enjoys pen and ink drawings and writing short stories about his adventures. In our final story of the night, let's go with Roger Poole back to 1948 with a surly animal and a neighbor who wasn't going to have any of it in Stanley's Mule.
Stanley's mule must have been having himself a good old stroll that fateful day in Wilton, Arkansas, in 1948, when he chanced to pass the Harris place. He was content to maintain a steady pace, clopping along with no care, no consideration of anything around him. Then, like a clap of thunder, he was startled as the scent of corn suddenly wafted across his nose. His nostrils flared to suck in more of the scent, and Stanley's mule stopped dead in his tracks. Wilton, Arkansas, was a thriving, bustling little burg which consisted of 2 dry goods stores, 3 gas stations, and several homes scattered about on either side of the Ashdown Highway. Everyone in Wilton knew everyone else, and everyone knew Stanley Hendricks' mule. And that's what they called him, Stanley's Mule. It just so happened that Stanley's mule, we'll call him Mule, had a special talent. He could open just about any door or gate just using his teeth. I must confess at this point in the story, I was only 5 years old. The only part of the story that I witnessed myself was the ending. The rest is a compilation of events as told to me by the other witness, my mom, and the victim herself, Florine Harris. Nevertheless, please know that this story is based in fact, mostly. So their mule stood in the middle of the road. Ah, corn, he thought. Dry corn, chops, chicken feed. If Purina had made a mule chow, this would be it. Mule turned his eager snout toward the rear of Florine Harris's house. There was corn back there, and it was going to be his. Like a lady leaping across a puddle, Mule stepped delicately across the small ditch at the edge of the road and meandered with growing purpose in the general direction of the corn's scent. Around the house he ambled with no fences and no Florine Harris to discourage his progress. Behind the house, Mule saw an outbuilding. He smelled the corn. His pace quickened as he nearly galloped to the small door that stood between a hungry mule and a bounty of luscious corn. Mule quickly sized up the locking mechanism that secured the door standing between him and lunch. It was not a real lock. It was one of those old-timey latch strings. There was just a string hanging out of a hole. A tug on the string would lift a small bar from its cradle and allow the door to open. Mule bit gently on the string, gave it a small, delicate tug. Shwing! The door came open, and inside was the storehouse of golden, illicit booty. Mule went right to the business of burglary, already having passed by breaking and entering. Well, here's the scene. Mule is munching away at the corn that Florine Harris had every right to expect would last through a season of chicken feeding. Florine was in her kitchen when she heard something unusual in the back of the house. One peek through her kitchen window and Florine knew everything. Mule was leaning into the outbuilding all the way up to his shoulders and was quickly laying waste to Florine's storehouse of corn. Florine was incensed. She had to take immediate and swift action. She crept quietly to the back door and she grabbed a mop leaning there as she exited. She needn't have worried about stealth. Mule's attention was completely focused on the corn. Florine approached the mule from behind. With gritted teeth, she rammed the mule repeatedly with the rounded end of the long red mop handle. He was so intent on sucking up so much corn as possible that he barely acknowledged her presence with a swish of his tail. While what happened next really did happen, how it happened is not readily apparent. Maybe Florine was sweating and her vision was impaired. Maybe she was so distraught from the heavy, heady mix of anger and fear that she was unaware of her own actions. Whatever the reason, Florine reared back, cocked her arms, tightened her grip, and with one swift forward thrust, she delivered one more mighty poke. Florine almost fell forward as the mop handle landed squarely on that puckered area just below the tail of the mule, which the mule had the unhappy luck of having flipped skyward. The puckered area was large and the mop handle was small. So when it landed, it didn't stop at the outer edge. Florine's follow-through put about 6 to 8 inches of mop handle into the back end of the mule. Now, up to the now, Mule had no reason to end his free meal of golden rich corn, dried corn kernels. Now he did. Mule had an instantaneous and involuntary urge to rid himself of the uninvited alien probe. Now at rest in his rear. Things started happening all at once. His eyes popped wide open. His rectum slammed shut. Unfortunately for Mule, his next action was ill-conceived. He reacted by taking flight in an attempt to leave behind the object of his irritation. He discovered with some discomfort that each time his rear hoofs hit the ground, the embedded object made its presence known by introducing a sharp pain at the point of contact. Mule was thus painfully encumbered as he reached the road out front and began his hasty retreat away from the Harris abode. He wanted to run, but was unable to accelerate due to the speed-retardant nature of the device, now waving up and down from his rear. My mother told others later that she was on our front porch sweeping an evening's worth of kid dirt when she heard the commotion up the road. Her memory was better than mine, as all I remember seeing was a two-tailed mule going down with a lady who was screaming out words I'd never heard before. Mama looked up the road and immediately recognized Mule as he approached, stutter-stepping down the road by our house. She said Mule was not quite running, but then he wasn't quite walking in his normal gait either. He was acting a little strange, she noted, and she was about to go back in the house to see to the safety of her other kids when she saw Florine Harris in hot pursuit of the mule. Overcome by curiosity, Mama decided to stay her ground and see what developed from this increasingly interesting picture before her, and where Mama was, so was I. Mule was not known for vocalization, and Mama was surprised to hear the animal almost move to human speech as he passed our house. She said the mule was uttering some mournful, guttural sound that sounded like old Grandpa Athey trying to clear his throat in the morning. As Mule passed the house, Mama noticed what appeared to be a perfectly good mop sticking out his back end. At this point, her attention was drawn to Florine, who was now gaining on the mule and had no intention of stopping to chat with Mom. Without even slowing down, Florine turned to Mom and offered what she must have thought was a full and appropriate explanation for this race with Stanley's mule. As she passed by our house in a dead run, arms flailing, legs reaching out in long, leaping strides, her voice trailed off like a train passing the depot, she yelled, "Well, it was a brand new mop!"
Roger Poole, the seventh and youngest child of Matt and storyteller Maxine, grew up in Nashville, Arkansas. He now lives in Bryant, Arkansas with wife Thelma. Roger enjoys writing truth to fictionalized word pictures. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
When it's getting dark, it doesn't matter if you're standing in the cold or heat. It's gonna get a lot hotter, only takes a spark, cause there's a party that's a blazing 7 nights a week, oh yeah. That Memphis boogie, that music is contagious, gotta grab that girl just to hold on to something when you hear that beat. There ain't no feeling like it in this whole round world, like the floor caught on fire, gotta move your feet, oh yeah. That Memphis boogie. Rhythm that they're playing make you shake your hips, so they've been dancing by the river in the crypt of the king. Well, there ain't no feeling like it off the pyramids. Well, you ain't a going to Egypt, you're in Tennessee. Oh yeah. That Memphis boogie. We'll be right back. So come on, baby, can't you hear that sound? Those drums are just a thumping, and I can't sleep. No! That's a mighty vibration burning up the ground. Well, it's got me wide awake and I can't feel it deep. Oh, yeah! So if you're ever in the depth of wind, it's getting dark. It doesn't matter if you're standing in the cold or heat. It's gonna get a lot hotter, only takes a spark. That's the Memphis Boogie.